1983 film Koyaanisqatsi created a sensation when initially released and left a powerful impression on everyone who's seen it over the last 30 years. With a purity of sound and vision that's rare in the modern cinema, the film has remained a prophetic vision for our culture, a meditation on our impact on the environment, and an exposé of the increasing imbalance at the root of modern life. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Today, I conclude my conversation with filmmaker and thinker Godfrey Reggio, recorded live on the stage of the Plaza Theater on the evening of August 11th, 2013. The conversation ranged far from just the specifics of making this iconic film to include inspiration, artistic struggles, the state of our civilization, and ultimately a little bit of the meaning of life. All of it applicable to the creation spark that all artists hope to capture, and this one did on film.
You and Ron Frick, who shot a lot of the footage, spent a lot of time modifying cameras, doing groundbreaking work on fast motion and slow motion photography, blurring these everyday world that we see, the man-made world that we are so proud of, almost making it the familiar alien again, and seeing it as part of a system, perhaps a distorted system. But you know, your traffic patterns are like eddies and streams, and you see people in fast motion being ingested into devices and being expelled out of devices, and just completely altering our perception, I think, of the mundane world we are in, and that we're trapped in this machinery, that we're not in control of this thing anymore that we've built.
Well, I would say that's clear, that we're not in the driver's seat. We're buckled in, but we're not driving the car right now. It has a life of its own. So it's not Mary's, it's not Hollywood's Frankenstein. It's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It's something that we've given a life of its own. The films are about perception. It's about seeing that which is most ordinary, most normal, that which is most familiar, most normal, most ordinary, are the things that we least see because they're the most present. So that which is most present is that which is least seen, the forest for the tree, etc. So how to show people traffic in another way means time-lapse photography, not using it as a punctuation, but using it as a main drive language so that it starts to speak. You start to see it in another way, as if an alien had arrived on the planet. If an alien arrives here, they would think that the automobile is the entity, and there are all these other people kind of servicing the automobile. So it's looking at the way we live, basically, trying to see it, feel it, experience it from another point of view. The reason music is important for these films, they're like the chair that you're sitting in right now for the experience. It serves as the equivalent of a narrative, but it's an emotive narrative that leaves you free to respond in every way you wish to respond.
It's almost a biological film to me. When you watch it, your whole being becomes part of it. It has a rhythm to it that pulls you in. Your heart rate, your breathing is manipulated through the imagery and the sound. It's like a stream that you're being pulled along with to find that meaning. And part of the experience is your collaboration with the great composer Philip Glass that sets some of that rhythm in motion and to imagery. How did that come about, working with Philip Glass?
For about 6 months in, let's say, 1976 now, I think, I took off 6 months. I worked with a woman who is a pianist and a composer, Marcia Mikulak, and she, being the bright person she was, knew most of the new music that was being composed all over the planet. So I heard, let's say, hundreds of new compositions. And when I heard Philip Glass, which was not the first person I heard, I said, that's the person. It's not that he's the best person. I don't believe in the best. The best is whatever you want to make it. He was the person that moved me. I felt his music was enormously cinematic because it didn't tell you what to think or feel. It left a certain freedom, and I love what appears to be the repetitive nature of his music. His music is not so much repetitive or minimalist, as it's called by critics. It's more metamorphic music. Rather than based in the 12-tone scale of Western classical music, it's based in more Vedic Hindu chant. It's based more like raga or jazz, but with definition, with composition. So it might seem simple, but there's an enormous amount of polyrhythmic notation going on. And one point of Koyaanisqatsi towards the latter part of the film, there are 12 polyrhythmic structures going on at once. I remember when people were first getting pacemakers, we showed it at a theater in New Mexico, and the gentleman's pacemaker flipped, and we had to have him taken out of the room, unfortunately. Fortunately, he was fine. But this kind of music can be intense because it's designed to give you an experience of this film. Now, let me just mention Ron Fricke, Philip Glass, Alton Walpole, Ray Jimenez, all these
Ray
people.
Jimenez is here.
Ray
Wave
Jimenez
Ray.
Is here. Ray and I have collaborated for like 42 years. These are obviously films way beyond my capacity, to be completely clear. I'm like a blind person that works through other people's eyes, deaf person through other people's ears. I don't want to give you the impression, however, that this is done by committee. I have to be everything from a mother to an assassin in order to pull this off and to act as if I know what I'm doing. But to be clear, to be absolutely clear, this is a collaborative form. All the people I work with have egos about the size of this room. However, they don't have vanity of ego. Vanity of ego does not allow you to live in a critical forum. It allows you to be precious. It allows you to think that you're the genius and everyone else has to bow to your idea. When you work in a collaborative forum, you're working with people of incredible talent. And we all, in some way, because we're making one film, not 25 different films, have to end up with the same breath, the same heartbeat, the same energy for the film. And that's not a given when you do collaboration. So it's one of the harder forms of doing a piece that ends up with a unity.
How did you know when you got there? I'm sure there was months, maybe even years, of shooting, editing, trying different takes, different sequences, different rhythms to the film. What was the moment you just thought, that's it?
Well, this film has been edited twice and mixed twice because the first edit and the mix were a complete failure, I felt. I have an angel that supports the film. That's somebody willing to make a bad deal for love of the project. And so the angel was willing to refund the edit and refund the mix of the film. And it's something that you know it when you feel it. I can't put it any other way. You also know it when you run out of money. So I learned also during that period the enormous benefit of the power of limits. So every time I've made a film since then, it's been within budget and on schedule. Not because of only the financing, but if that doesn't happen, then you could literally work the rest of your life on something. You'll never bring it to completion. You all know people like myself and the rest of you that sometimes just can't make up their mind about anything. This is important. If you're making a film, to have the isometric of this limit, it gives you, it's like a boilerplate for some big energy. Without that, you could be floundering.
It occurs to me that this this film came out over 30 years ago, and its central theme of life being out of balance. 30 years later, this was before cell phones, smartphones, iPods, iPads, Apples, Macs, IBM, Botox, Iraq, Afghanistan. Are you more pessimistic about where we're going at this point? Are you hopeful?
Well, I'm a hopeful person because I believe hope is what you hope for. So can I be optimistic about what's going on in the world? I don't think so. It doesn't mean that I'm a pessimist, or you could call me a pessimistic optimist, but it's all like just a word play. I think we're in a very intense moment. In fact, I feel it's so intense that it's untellable. It's unsayable. We live in a world that's no longer being made available for human habitation, much less the habitation of the rest of the creatures on the planet that we share. We no longer live with nature. We live off nature. It is, from my point of view, the raw material that we consume to support the affluence of our technological way of living. And the price we pay for the pursuit of that affluence, for me, is the destruction of the home we live in, the destruction of our languages, of our cultures, of our way of living, of our children. So to me, it's unspeakable, it's unsayable what's happening. It has nothing to do with right and left. As I said, as horrible as wars are, as genocide is, as all these horrible things that you can see on the television, they pale by comparison to the horror, for me, of ordinary daily living, that which we all embrace, that which we support. That would, to support the way we live now, we have to take down practically the rest of the planet. I did a film, Powakatsi, about the relationship of Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere societies, societies of affluence and industrialization, and societies of orality and handmade living. As it so happens, most of the resources that are available still are in that zone that is, quote, undeveloped in the Southern Hemisphere. So Northern Hemisphere societies predate on Southern Hemisphere societies for the resources that they need to continue the affluent way of life that we have. So I think we're in a very, let's say, very transformative moment. Again, what we can know is so small compared to what is unknown that I couldn't begin to say what's going to happen, but I can see what is happening. And there is a very rare grammatical text, I think only used once in the Bible, and it's called the future present. Bob Dylan knew about it. He wrote it, "It's blowing in the wind." We can all see the future in the present if we only open our languages, our eyes, to see what's really going on. But we're all kept busy making a living or trying to make ends meet, not any longer celebrating who we are. So these are like heady things to say at a film festival, so you'll have to excuse me. But these are the intentions for which the film is made.
I'm just feeling blessed right now. I hope you are, that he's just communicated with us.
Thank you.
Director
Thank you.
Godfrey Reggio.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with director Godfrey Reggio, recorded live on the stage of the Plaza Theater before a screening of his iconic 1983 film, Koyaanisqatsi. You could hear a pin drop in the cavernous Plaza Theater during our conversation, and more than a few attendees that evening remarked that they had something akin to a religious experience listening to Reggio and watching Koyaanisqatsi. No higher praise for a work of art and its creator. Celebrating the 30th anniversary of the theatrical release of the film, Koyaanisqatsi, along with its two kindred sequels, has been restored and released by the Criterion Collection on DVD and Blu-ray. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.